Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Small Animal Practice and Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European Veterinary Specialist in Internal Medicine, Domingo Casamianza Russell. Thank you, Domingo. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hi, thank you very much, Sami. Hello to everyone. Thank you for coming to this seminar. I'm just gonna try to open the screen a bit more. Sorry, yep, that should do. I think that's fine. So, yeah, thank you everyone for coming. As Sami says, I'll be very happy to entertain questions at any time. So, I think if you want to ask through the presentation rather than waiting until the end, that's absolutely fine. Unless there are many, and then we might just leave them for the end. But please ask along the way and stop me, and then we can have a chat about things. So yeah, we are just going to we're going today to talk about atrial fibrillation. We're going to talk in terms of going through the etiopathogenesis of atrial fibrillation, the causes, what type of presentations we see in practice, a very common arrhythmia in practice, and also what type of treatments we can implement as well. So yeah, atrial fibrillation is certainly a very common arrhythmia. I don't think it's been quantified in terms of what percentage of the arrhythmia we see in practice, and I think that both in general practice or referral practice, but it's certainly a very common arrhythmia we all see, and it's just the type of things we tend to say that it is an arrhythmia that everyone, you know, in a normal practice will see, maybe in a small practice once a year, and in a busy practice maybe once a month, something like that. So it's certainly quite common. Definition-wise, is classified. There are three, depending on duration, there are three main sub-stages, we could say, or sub-classifications for it. One is a paroxysmal AF. This is considered to be less than 7 days. And this is important because these are within that bracket of time, then it could be, it's easier that it is converted to a normal rhythm spontaneously or with drugs, but it is where it's kind of like the period where the arrhythmia hasn't settled down and it might still be back to normal rhythm. In people and in horses, for example, as well, sometimes it's used 48 hours. So I think between up to 48 hours and 7 days, it's what's used for paroxysmal AF, particularly in dogs. I mean, 48 hours, for example, in people is important because it's the time where, you know, depending on where you're going to do cardioversion, which we'll talk about later, when you need to use antithrombotic therapy as well, etc. But obviously that doesn't apply to us. We'll talk about it later. So paroxysmal AF, less than 7 days, potentially within 48 hours. And within that time, it is easier, they can convert spontaneously. Persistent AF is an AF that lasts for more than 7 days, but still is amenable for, or is considered still amenable for cardioversion. And again, all this classification comes from humans, of course, but I think it's nice to have it in mind. And then permanent will be once the arrhythmia is accepted. So it's accepted, the arrhythmia is there, it's going to always stay there, and what we're going to do is, we're going to do rhythm control. And that might be, I mean, often in humans will be because you've done cardioversion. It might be the same in dogs, or obviously ablation has been tried. But that permanent cardioversion is what we tend to see. It's very rare in dogs to see paroxysmal AF. So usually when someone is looking at an ECG, then AF is there or it's not there. So we always say if you think that at one part of the ECG there is AF and the other part of the ECG there's no AF, just think about it again, because it's not common. It can happen, and it happens, and we see in halters, etc. But the most common thing is that AF is there or is not there. So if you see sinus rhythm one part of the ECG, then maybe what you're thinking is AF, maybe it's not. So just think twice or have another look at it. I'll try to go, well, subtly, I would say through these slides. So in terms of electrophysiological mechanism, obviously we know that the normal electrical impulse in the heart, it started, at the sinus nodes. Okay, so that we've got here. I'm not sure if I'm mar no, the arrow is here. Sorry, let me see. Get the arrow. Ah, it's just here. Thank you. So basically, you've got the sinus node there, and that's going to create the electrical impulse. And then, obviously, this electrical impulse is going to change cells from negative polarity to positive, and then we're going to have the calcium in, and then we're going to have contraction. Yeah? So basically, the electrical impulse is started here at the sinus node, and then it's transmitted through all the atria. Okay. That's transmitted cell to cell, but also through these pathways, which are several of them. After this, so one, there is the depolarization of the atria, or the electrical impulse going through the atria, running through the atria. That's what we see on the ECG as a P wave. Yeah, P wave is the depolarization of the atria. Then we go through the AV nodes, and the AV node will be the PR interval, or there's a pause of depolarization. So there's a stoppage of a depolarization wave within the heart. All the atria is depolarized already. The ventricle hasn't been depolarized yet. Once the impulse goes to the AV nodes, it's just like keeping that impulse going. Then there is the rapid depolarization of the ventricles, okay, through the bundles and his and the bundles, etc. And we get the QRS complex on the ECG. And then the repolarization, the passage of cells from positive to negative again, so that will be represented as a T wave, the ventricular repolarization. So usually we have, again, depolarization of the atria, P waves, then PR interval, just the impulse is just basically hidden in the AV node, and then the depolarization of the ventricles, which is the QRS complex that we see on the ECG. Atrial fibrillation, the mechanism of atrial fibrillation is you could say like there's not going to be P wave, there's not going to be an organized depolarization in the atria. We were saying that the waves go through, so you get a nice P wave. So the depolarization of the atria is going to be a chaotic depolarization, and usually, so you're going to have multiple, which might call micro reentrant circuits. Along the atria, depolarizing and keeping themselves going, okay, all the time. That causes, heart rates within the atria of up to 500, 600, 700, 800 beats per minute. That will be important to bear in mind. And those are all going to be all those flutter wave, or not flutter, sorry, but all these F wave or small waves, small fluctuations of the baseline. That we are going to see on the ECG. Okay, so there's a depolarization of the atria at 500, 800 beats per minute. It's all chaotic. It is not known really whether, I mean, well, there are different theories, whether this, and possibly they and depending on the cases and the overlap, etc., whether these are small reentrant circuits in the atria, you see all these lines. Whether they and they are supposed to be up to 20 to be self-sustained. Whether these depolarization circuits, whether they are organized, so they're always the same, whether they are completely disorganized, so you've got I don't know 30 of these small circuits just going round, 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 and then they are different ones later. Whether there is a mother rotor, so there is one circuit that breaks down into many, etc. I mean, it is clear that there is a this is in at least in humans, it is triggered by some ectopics coming from the pulmonary veins as well. So all this eventually, what was important for us, I think, is it gets to this No P wave because the atria is depolarized through these multiple different reentrant circuits. And then the impulse, these 500, 800 beats per minute, gets to the AV nodes, okay, compared to the impulse that comes from the from a normal sinus depolarization to a normal P wave, which you will have normal heart rate, 120, whatever. You're having a bombarded sinus AV nodes at 500, 600, 700 beats per minute, and the AV node has the task of filtering this. If it doesn't filter this, then what will happen will be ventricular fibrillation, obviously at this heart rate, and then that's not sustainable or compatible with life. So the AV node has to filter. This is important, and it does to some extent, but obviously not perfectly, because they still, most of the times, they will come with rapid heart rates. So this is important because the most important part of the treatment is going to be to filter these 500 to 800 beats per minute. Or the AV node, helping the AV node to filter these rapid rhythms, this rapid heart rate that comes from the atria into something sustainable, something that is not too bad for the heart. Okay. So this is the main kind of going through electrophysiological. I won't go anymore. And just I had a picture here of how. Just with coloring or different polarities, how all this the depolarization occurs in the atria during atrial fibrillation is quite nice. You see a different color. This is the idea or the hypothesis of the mother rotor, and this is just more chaotic. But you see, there's not a wave of depolarization which is organized. So, in terms of atrial fibrillation or why it happens, it's not very well really known. I mean, why it happens, etc. Rather than just a single cause, it's multifactorial, and there needs to be several factors that makes this arrhythmia happening. They are classified in three types. One is substrates, another one is triggers, another one is perpetuators. Substrates. Importantly, it's very important that for AF to occur, you need to have a big atria just to sustain all those small circuits. Again, you need to have they say at least 20 or around that number to sustain those small circuits that they kind of self-sustain, and it keeps going and keeps going. It needs to be a big heart. That's why you wouldn't have, and it's just a picture here, but you wouldn't have a atrial fibrillation in a rat, for example, with this small heart. It just can't happen. As the species, as they get bigger, then it's going to be easier for them to have AF. And we all know that horses very commonly have AF, and we'll talk about cats later. They need to have a big heart for cats to have AF. A normal heart, they won't develop AF. So that's important. So we need to have a big atria. Also, on top of big atria, if there is parts of the atria which have got anatomical boundaries, like scarring, for example, atrial scarring with age or with disease, then that's gonna make more easier for these small circuits to occur. There will be blockage of the depolarization in those areas, and then around those scarry areas, you could form a circuit, for example. So any atrial disease basically becoming the atria becomes big, becomes disease with scarring, etc., could cause AF potentially. And then on top of this, so we've got this substrate, so we need to have this atria, which can sustain AF, which is prone to have AF, which is just basically a good nidus for AF, we could say. And then we're going to have triggers, things that will happen that will start this arrhythmia. What are going to be? A typical one is changes in autonomic tone. So changes in sympathetic, parasympathetic tone, they're going to cause changes in the dispersion of depolarization, or in the way depolarization happen at different areas within the heart, within the atria, etc., etc. And all that's going to make the heart prone to reentrant mechanisms, because some cells will be a bit less negative, or they're more negative, etc., etc., within a localized region, and that will make AF more easily started or triggered. And supraventricular ectopics, we've said, if we've got a supraventricular ectopic at the right time in a substrate heart which is prone to AF, then it's going to just kick in. AF will kick in. And then it's always said that AF kind of fits AF. So the more AF there is, the more likely AF will be sustained and will stay there. And that's the rationale of if you're going to convert this rhythm, you do it the sooner the better. Because otherwise there are changes in the atria which happen secondary to the AF. Nothing to do with the underlying disease, nothing to do with the trigger. But actually the AF itself causes this the atria to change in a way which is better to sustain the AF. And those changes will be both electrophysiological changes, so there will be changes in the electrophysiology of some of the cells within the atria or many of the cells within the atria, and also histopathological changes. A common thing that is being seen is that AF will cause atrial fibrosis and atrial scarring, and that again is going to just cause more and more atrial remodeling. And it's quite common. We see in dogs, you know, you diagnose one of these lone AFs, and we'll talk about lone AF later. And then when you see lone AF, you know, you see this heart, you follow them, and the atria becomes bigger and bigger. And then it's hard to say, is there a cardiomyopathy affecting the atria, or is it the AF itself? And many of these is just the AF itself. Or when we pick them up, the atria is a bit big or slightly enlarged. There's no mitral regurg. There's nothing major, you know, making sense why that atria is enlarged. And then we think, oh, is there a cardiomyopathy affecting the atria, myocarditis of the atria, or is it just the AF which has caused the remodeling? So that's why, you know, if it can be converted, it's important to convert AF. But again, that's not the common thing in our cases. So most of our cases will do rhythm control, but we'll talk about it later. So basically, in physical examination, what we will see will be when we examine, and that's always with the students and the residents, what we say is you need to, you know, once you hear AF a few times, you just get used to it, and then you know it's AF just almost by listening. But again, it's like the rule of arrhythmias, isn't it? Like, you don't diagnose arrhythmias auscultating. You can suspect, don't worry, you just take an ECG and then you make a diagnosis. So is there an arrhythmia? Yes, let's take an ECG. But it's true that AF is quite characteristic, and there's quite things that are pathognomonic. So we're going to have a chaotic rhythm. Typical two things that are said is like shoes in a tumble dryer or like fireworks as well. So it's this chaotic rhythm, like so that sort of thing. We had an audio of a couple of AS, but we couldn't put them through. So I hope that impersonation works a bit for you. And then the other key thing is you've got this this rhythm irregular, this that sort of thing, and then that's combined. Remember, always you auscultate the heart, or particularly if you auscultate an arrhythmia, but it's useful, at least for some part of the auscultation, to feel the pulse as well. So when you're feeling the pulse, you'll see pulse deficits. Okay, so irregular rhythm, very irregular rhythm with pulse deficits, typical one. And then the heart rate is variable. Usually it doesn't go above 216 dogs. If you've got a heart rate of 330, something like that, usually that's something else in dogs. It's going to be a SVT of different characteristic, different type. And cats might go up to 300 beats per minute. But the heart rate is variable. So we have all these lone AFs, and you can have, the usual thing, dog with DCM, in heart failure, yes, they will come with heart rates of 220, 200, 240, wherever. But there are many cases that might present with lone AF as well. So AF, which is low heart rates. And these are difficult sometimes to pick up, particularly you know, big dogs, etc. So they might be confused with sinus rhythm. That's why it's important to feel the pulse. Okay. Although some of these, if the heart rate is very slow, it happens the same in horses, they might not have pulse deficits, okay? Because obviously the heart rate is so slow that there's, even if the ventricular filling hasn't been perfect, still is enough to generate a pulse. So that's a bit of difference. But the majority of cases, we're going to have pulse deficits. And then on clinical presentation, on physical presentation, we are going to see other features of the underlying disease. So we are going to see if we got heart disease, as very common, like DCM or mitral valve disease, let's say, we are going to see, we are going to hear the murmur, we are going to hear maybe gallop sounds, etc. We might have the consequences of the congestive heart failure or the heart failure that is present. So we might have tachypnea, if it's left-sided heart failure, we might have pulmonary edema, so with tachypnea, and we might have ascites and jugular distension if we've got right-sided heart failure, which is common for big dogs with, you know, atrial fib and etc. to have right-sided heart failure. It might be if the trigger is systemic disease, we might have signs of systemic disease. Again, if we've got abdominal disease, that's triggered an AF, which is not extremely uncommon in a large breed dog, then it might be that we've got the systemic disease, peritonitis, or we have a GDV or something like that. And then intestinal foreign body, for example, we had one last week. And then it could be normal. Many dogs will present an AF, they're fine, and it could be normal. Or some dogs, okay, not the majority. Majority present in heart failure and with rapid heart rates. So ECG diagnosis, so we suspect there is an arrhythmia, we possibly suspect there is AF. And then what are the features, the key features of diagnosing AF? Key features are, it is a supraventricular rhythm. It means that we have narrow QRS complexes, okay? So these are the four major questions you have to always ask on an ECG. There are a few others, but these are the main one. Is the rhythm supraventricular or ventricular? In AF, the rhythm is supraventricular. Is the rhythm, are there P waves for every QRS complex for every P? In AF, there are not. There are no P waves. You do have a fluctuation of the waveline, of the baseline, sorry, fluctuation of the baseline with no obvious P waves, okay? No consistent P waves. Is the rhythm regular or irregular? In AF, the rhythm will be irregular, and it will be regularly irregular, okay? So you see how there's no regularity on this ECG, okay? And then is the heart rate, is there a tachycardia or a bradycardia, etc.? That's the question, the fourth question, fourth main question. And in the heart rate usually will be high in AF, but we'll have a look at a few examples now. So the four questions, so it's a supraventricular rhythm, that means narrow complexes, yeah, remember. If you struggle with saying, oh, is it narrow or is it wide, because that happens, you could measure it. And if you measure it, it should be less than 70 milliseconds, okay? 70 milliseconds, that would make two, at 50 millimeters per second, that would make two squares, two and a bit of a square, okay? Two and a quarter of a square, that sort of thing, okay? And then, yeah, irregular, no P waves, and then heart rate. It is important with the P waves, I think we'll talk about it now, but it is important with the P waves, that you don't focus on whether there are P waves or not. Because, you know, sometimes you might just look at it, and if I go to these are all AFs, and if I go here, I say, oh, look, and there might be a P wave here, so it can't be AF. But then you need to see consistent P wave, okay? So if you're not sure, you say, oh, this might be a P wave, you know, that one, or this one here, you know, that's a P wave, so it has to be, no, but you have to look at the whole thing. It's just irregular baseline, yeah, there's some fluctuation, etc. So again, don't focus in if there is one P wave, you're going to say, oh, it can't be AF, because you know, you just have to look at the whole context, and it has to be a consistent P wave. The second thing is, don't look at the F waves. The key thing is looking at supraventricular rhythm, irregular, and usually a rapid heart rate. Just forget about the fluctuating baseline. Because we apply filters, and you don't know what filter possibly you're applying on your ECG, etc., etc. And, you know, it might be that you don't have the typical or the F waves, and that's not uncommon. Also, you know, it might not be the best of recordings, etc., etc. Okay, so thinking on heart rates, you know, yeah, AF, we call AF here a heart rate of 255 beats per minute. Here an AF a bit slower, 180. So maybe this is a typical one that presents in heart failure. This one may be heart failure, and it's just a bit lower heart rate. The AV node is able to process to stop most a bit more of those 500, 800 beats per minute waves that are coming on a depolarization are coming from the atria. We've got here a kind of a lone AF, heart rates of 70 beats per minute. So this is, you know, again, we'll talk about it later, but occasionally they present like this. These ones might be a bit more difficult to auscultate on and say they are not sinus rhythm. But again, you take an ECG, they're not P waves. This fluctuating baseline, irregularly regular. The key thing is that it's just very regularly regular AF, very regularly regular. And then you have to be careful not to confuse those with supraventricular rhythms. So we've got here a sinus beat, and then we've got an SVT here, SVT, and then we've got sinus rhythm again, PQRS, PQRS, PQRS. So, you know, when you are auscultating, you say, oh, this could be AF. Well, again, some SVTs are slightly irregular. But it's just AF. The key thing is they're so irregularly irregular. You see there's no pattern at all. And you just see, if you measure, to check whether they're irregular or not, remember, you could use calipers, or you could use, So you can use calipers, or you can use a piece of paper. Piece of paper, you mark, so you put a piece of paper here, let's say, here. You mark with a line here, and then you move across the piece of paper here. You see the different here, etc. Then you see how irregularly irregular is. So that's important. So my advice is don't eyeball it. Don't eyeball that the rhythm is irregularly regular. Always measure it. Always put the calipers or just a piece of paper. Make sure it's regular or irregular. If you eyeball it, you might be wrong. I mean, if it's a typical one, that's fine. But you start seeing this one, for example, you might just start being confused. When the heart rate is higher, it can be more irregular. Okay, it can look more regular, I mean. Fine. With the F waves, what I was saying, if it's important, try really not to look at F waves. Just forget about F waves, because you might get confused with this, and you might just get through the wrong path. Sometimes we have electromechanical dissociation here. So what I mean is like the artifact caused by electromagnetic forces. So basically, you do have here, these are the typical artifacts of electrical artifact we see on the ECG. So that has to be sorted with better contacts, a table that is not, doesn't conduct electromagnetic fields. Make sure there's nothing around you that is might be an electromagnetic field, things like that. But we, you know, you might get confused with these things. The second is an example of some AF with a huge filter. If you look at this, then there's no F waves here, aren't they? So it's just all a huge filter, and then you have to be careful with this. And then obviously the main differential with the atrial flutter. You know, atrial flutter is a different arrhythmia. It's a macro reentrant, so around the heart. So rather than having multiple small circuits in the heart, we've got a big one going round. It just goes round and round and round. Okay, so it's a bit of a different arrhythmia. And we can see those F, capital F waves, they are called, you know, here. Okay. Okay, those things. Okay, so it's a bit different. So you don't have, you know, if you look at the AF, you don't have those massive F capital waves. The rhythm in atrial flutter could be regular or irregular, and depends. It's a bit more organized than AF, but it could be disorganized sometimes as well. Well, I think if you don't get, like, I think if you make a diagnosis of, oh, could it be AF or could be atrial flutter, that's quite good enough. I mean, often they are treated similarly in practice, I think that's fine. And indeed, some atrial flutters end being AF. These are what called fibrillar flutters, etc. So they kind of overlap a bit sometimes as well. In general, it's a supraventricular rhythm. But sometimes, like this example here, you see these are white complexes. Yeah, you see white complexes here. Sometimes we've got depolarization changes So we've got aberrancy of conduction, so a slow conduction through the ventricle because of maybe bundle branch block or because of other conduction aberrancies. And then we may have wide QRS complexes. So rather than having narrow, which is a typical one, we may have wide. So if we've got a big left ventricle, for example, we may start having big conduction aberrancies. We may start having wide QRS complexes. So if we've got, so you have to bear in mind. But again, it's just so classically regularly regular. So if it sounds like AF, it looks like AF. Very regular, no P waves, but it's just the complexes are wider than normal. That's not going to be a VTach. VTachs are vast majority, almost always regular. They're regular rhythms because they are most of the times reentrant, unless they're an idioventricular rhythm, but then it will be a lower heart rate, and they are not as irregular. AF, a low heart rates, AF will be very, very regular. If you've got a ventricular rhythm that's a bit irregular at lowish heart rates, then they are very regular. So look for that irregularity and always measure it, etc. And if it sounds like AF, it's very regular, no P waves, but it's just a bit wide, it's just AF, okay? And then sometimes we have AF, like this one, this is from a Holter recording. So we've got AF. You see the difference, the irregularity, yeah? So this is one distance, RRE distance. Then we get a different, a smaller one, narrower one, got bigger one. Here again, we've got a narrower one. While every single R to R interval is completely different, it's typical of AF. Sometimes you get intercalated ventricular complexes, or it is cardiac disease often. So sometimes you can have ventricular arrhythmias as well. So you've got AF, but on top of that, you've got ventricular rhythms as well. Okay, so just yeah, that would be. Occasionally, you will have. Speed, we could say speed dependent aberrancy or changes in depolarization. So you will have QRS complexes which will be wider just at certain speeds when the heart rate is faster, for example. That can happen. So you've got blocks at that time. But again, you can have also ventricular rhythms like this one. Again, if you want to, so I've kind of finished with the description how to diagnose AF with the ECG and what to focus on. If you want to ask me something now, I'm very happy to go through if you I don't know, anything. So yeah, that's open for questions for sure at the moment. Fine. So I'm no questions so far. So what I'm gonna do is I'm going to go through now to underlying disease. Okay, so underlying disease, we've discussed a bit about it, but basically, just to make it simple, any cardiac disease leading to atrial enlargement could cause potentially atrial fibrillation. Okay, so we know any cardiac disease, and we'll talk about it now in the next slide. But basically, any disease causing atrial is just usually it's DCM, but any cardiac disease can cause atrial enlargement really with time, mitral valve disease. It's much more common to have DCM, atrial fib in DCM because usually it's bigger dogs, the heart is bigger, the atria is bigger. But with mitral valve disease as well, in big atrias, we can see AF, although it's not as common. Again, it's just always looking at these big dogs having AF. Any disease of the affecting the atria or causing atrial enlargement. And then with that adequate substrate, when we've got big atria, there will be the triggers. If we've got systemic disease, that can cause that can trigger changes in sympathetic tone, inflammation, etc., etc., and that can trigger potentially AF. Changes in autometric tone are common when they've got in pain, for example. So they've got pain, and then the pain subsides a bit with opioid, and then that sort of thing. And then there will be a vagal effect as well. Is that sort of sympathetic, parasympathetic drive and changes, abrupt changes in sympathetic, parasympathetic tone that can cause this type of arrhythmia? Okay, so always look at that. But yeah, underlying abdominal inflammatory diseases in the abdomen, for example. Etc., etc. So usually we have in dogs, we have three types of presentation for AF. First, we have the typical dog with severe cardiac disease and left atrial enlargement. And the dog is usually, when the time they present, the dog is usually in congestive heart failure. So there's a typical presentation, 90, we'll say 99%, 95% of cases you'll see will be this presentation. We see as well. Second will be that large dog with lone, I put them lone as that, lone AF. So dog is absolutely fine, comes from vaccination. Someone thinks, oh, this rhythm is not normal, take an ECG, dog has gone AF. We talk about it. And then the third typical presentation, again, the second and third are much less common. First one is the top one. The third will be the dog that comes with abdominal disease or systemic disease or is treated with opioids or things like that, and then bung, suddenly AF develops. Okay? In front of your eyes, usually. So he's in the hospital, he's in sinus rhythm, and suddenly AF develops. What shall we do with those? We'll talk about it now. And then AF in cats. AF in cats is a completely different story. Different story. As we say, we need to have, remember that rat heart, the small, small heart? So we need to have a big heart to be able to have AF. So usually, all cats, if you've got a cat with AF, then always they've got cardiac disease. And usually it's cardiomyopathy, because cardiomyopathy is the most common disease in the heart. So usually we're just going to have something like that, a restricted cardiomyopathy. And we are going to have big atrias, risk of smoke. You can see some smoke there in the heart. So you have here left atrium, left ventricle. Here is a view of the left atrium with smoke, slow moving blood, smoke. That's typical. That's a risk. That's telling you that there's a risk of thromboembolism. And the thing is, if there is AF, the risk of thromboembolism increases further. Because you do have an atria which is not moving at all. Okay, possibly at end stages won't be moving at all anyway. But AF in humans, there's a high risk of thromboembolism. In dogs, we don't see that clearly associated. Although we see cases where they've got big atria and AF, and then they develop a thromboembolism, but it's rare. But obviously, in cats, the risk will be even increased higher, but they will possibly be on treatment anyway. Okay, but yes, basically, cats, they need to have severe cardiac disease. It is so rare that there's one publication of a cat that developed AF in a cat that the left atrium was normal, and that was published that case because it's so rare. And this cat developed big cardiac disease later, so had underlying cardiac disease. And yeah, basically, all the cases of cats with AF, you're going to see they will have severe, severe, severe cardiac disease, which will make the atria be very, very large, very, very big. Okay. So I think after this, we're just going to go out and talk about treatments. Okay. Again, just passing through to the next thing. If anyone wants to ask me something now, I'm very happy to answer now. Go through something in terms of disease or treatment, in a disease or diagnosis. Fine. So we just carry on with treatment fundamentals. The first thing is there are two types of treatments aim. One will be rate control. That will mean that we accept atrial fibrillation. It's going to stay there forever. But what we want to do is we want to slow the heart rate. Okay? That's the main aim. Or rhythm control. Rhythm control is a different strategy. Rarely we use this in dogs. It usually is used by cardiologists. We treat some dogs that way. But in rare cases, most of the times we do rate control. Rate control, we're going to focus on treating the underlying disease. Typical one is treating congestive heart failure. If we are thinking for rate control, what we are doing is we are trying to make the AV node, just going to mark it, just say, remember that AV node is filtering those 500, 600, 700, 800 beats per minute atrial depolarizations. Those electrical impulses can go so fast. So the AV node is blocking them. And we're helping to block the AV node. The first thing, so we are basically increasing thromotropy. Thromotropy is increased. The best way to start with to increase thromotropy is to or to sorry to decrease the entropy, to increase conduction. The best way to decrease the entropy would be mean increasing the blockage of the electrical impulse. The best way is to or to increase the parasympathetic tone and decrease or decrease sympathetic tone. So that's why it's very important if you've got an underlying disease, you need to treat the disease. Because for example, congestive heart failure, the first thing that happens is you got a massive sympathetic tone, a very high sympathetic release. That's where you get high heart rates, etc., etc. Okay, so if you treat the heart failure, your sympathetic tone will decrease, parasympathetic tone will come back, will increase again, and that's going to help the AV node to filter those waves. So that's why it's so important to treat well the congestive heart failure in these cases. Or if the AF is associated with something else, like if you've got pain somewhere or things like that, then you need to treat that as well as possible. And then after we've done that, we've done kind of the natural way, we just try to increase the parasympathetic tone. The same way, the second thing we'll do will be to use negative dromotropes. Okay, so we're gonna decrease dromotropy with drugs. Okay, usually it will be drugs that will decrease conduction through the AV nodes, and they usually work. It's rare we cannot control AF. I think it's very rare. And we'll talk about something we can do afterwards if that's not working, but usually, I mean, it's very, very rare. You cannot control AF with drugs. Atrial flutter, for example, is a different story, maybe. For rhythm control, to control, we can use drug therapy. The main drug we tend to use in these days is amiodarone. So we use usually class 3 drugs. Potentially, you could use class 1 as well. But usually, class 3 drugs. So amiodarone, potentially, you could use sotalol as well. But amiodarone is the one that will work better. Or we can do electrical cardioversion. It's just deliver an electrical shock, stop, so make silent all the cells, and then hope for the sinus node to start again normally. Okay. But again, the most common situation, and we're gonna have a couple of cases now, will be rate control. I'm just gonna go through a couple of cases. What drugs are we gonna use for controlling, for helping controlling that AV nodal conduction here? We're going to use calcium channel blockers. The main one is going to be diltiazem. Diltiazem is the key treatment, the key medication that we use. Remember, with diltiazem, it's very important that you know what type of diltiazem you're using. There are three or four types. So one is diltiazem non-sustained release. The other one is medium release. Slow release, it's called SR, X or XR. So you've got normal one, MR, SR, XR. And they've got different lengths. Usually we will use diltiazem non-sustained release 3 times a day. Medium release, usually 3 times a day. Some people use it twice a day, but usually 3 times a day. SR, 3 times a day. SR, twice a day, sorry. So repeat. Normal diltiazem 3 times a day, MR 3 times a day. Some people use twice a day, SR three twice a day, or SR twice a day. SR is the one that we use very commonly. And we say some people use two, three. It's just there are no studies. Okay, so there's some studies pending there. We don't have studies on the half-lives, etc., of all of these different release formulation in dogs, but that's how it tends to do, and it tends to work well. Yeah, SR twice a day, MR 3 times a day, or twice a day. It's important with this MR, SR that you don't break the tablets down, okay? Because they are coated. If you break the tablets down, you might have a peak of action very fast, and it could be dangerous as well, okay? So you cannot break these tablets up. Usually, you start with low doses and you increase gradually, okay? Increase gradually, doses above 1 mg/kg are usually required, and then different release formulations. And that's what I mentioned now. And then the other main drug is digoxin or digoxin. Yeah. And basically, it's a cardioglycoside. And usually, by itself, is not enough in most cases. So usually, you tend to use diltiazem or a combination of diltiazem and digoxin. There was a study that showed the combination was better than digoxin by itself. And then usually you start, we would recommend to start a very low dose, and then increase rapidly. Be careful with toxicity, okay? Because the last thing we want for these dogs is not eating or start having problems. And usually with digoxin toxicity, what we tend to say is we see first the inappetence, they are not eating, a bit of diarrhea, maybe things like that, rather than the more dramatic arrhythmias, okay, the dramatic changes like arrhythmias, for example. So the GI signs are possibly the first things we see. So you need to start at low doses, be careful, and then you need to keep an eye on levels and monitor levels after 4 or 5 days, okay. You can use beta blockers if to slow that conduction through the AV nodes, but usually because the patient is in heart failure, etc., then you best avoid those, okay? Because beta blockers will decrease inotropy, so we decrease systolic function. So you could actually, it could be extremely dangerous to use beta blockers, and you can't use beta blockers when a patient is in congestive heart failure. You just can't, and so you just have to avoid that. By bad cases, if the heart failure is under control, then maybe it's a drug to consider. But again, I think those are situations where the case needs to be assessed by a cardiologist. And amiodarone, again, class 3, but has got all the other four properties as well, particularly class 1. And it's useful, for example, if there's ventricular arrhythmia as well. Amiodarone, again, I always say if you're going to use amiodarone, then you need to consult with a cardiologist as well. Amiodarone has got a long life, long half-life, and has got side effects, in particular liver, GI signs, liver disease, long-term. And a few others in dogs, those two main, they can cause hypothyroidism as well. So yeah, it's always something to ask advice. It's just rare that a dog cannot be controlled well if you treat the heart failure, diltiazem and digoxin, or just diltiazem. It's rare. So it's rare you will need to use those. So we just go to a few ca three cases I've got. So the case one is Bella. Bella is again. If you want to stop me now before we go into the cases, I'm very happy to go through any questions, entertain with any questions. So that's fine. Okay, I'll carry on. But yeah, I just remind you in case you want. So the first case is Bella. Bella is a 9-month-old whippet. He was diagnosed with mitral valve dysplasia. And at the time of presentation, he was tachypneic and tachycardic, like all dogs in congestive heart failure are, unless they've got AV blocks or something. So, heart failure, left side heart failure, tachycardia. It's typical classical. At the time, we hear an irregular heart rhythm. There are pulse deficits, and the dog presents in circulatory collapse, in shock, yeah, cardiogenic shock. The dog has just been only partially responsive to furosemide. Okay, just for an assessment. This is the Bella's ECG. If anyone wants to comment this ECG, I'll be very happy to just if you write it down if you want to, or I can go through it. I'll wait a few seconds. If someone is keen, comment a bit. Okay, I'll go through. I think it'll be a bit difficult format actually wise, if you have to write it down, I think. So fair enough. So basically, four things we look at. Is this a supraventricular or ventricular rhythm? It's a supraventricular rhythm because we've got narrow QRS complexes. Cannot be ventricular. Okay. Occasionally you get a ventricular rhythm that comes from the his area, etc. But yeah, it's supraventricular rhythm. Is the tachycardia? Normal rhythm bradycardia, it's tachycardia, 255 beats per minute. You could calculate it here, 255 beats per minute. It's a tachycardia, supraventricular. Okay, we've narrowed the differentials a lot. We've ruled out ventricular rhythms, we've ruled out normal rhythms, and so we're looking at what type of rhythm. Have we got P waves? Look carefully, and it's important to have six leads, yeah, like you have here, because then you might pick up in one lead a P wave or something. So always try to have a six lead, if not 12. Okay, but six leads. So we don't have P waves here. Okay, so if you look, there's no consistent P waves. I'm sure you can make one or two and say, oh, this is a P wave. It has to be consistent, something that you really think is P wave. Is it a regular or irregular rhythm? Can be more irregular than this, can it? So you have short every interval is almost different. See, long, short. So that will sound like, like two, 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 that sort of thing. Okay, so typical AF. There's no doubt this dog is in AF. Okay, take X-rays. We have a massive left atrial enlargement. Massive left atrial enlargement. Huge cardiomegaly, elevated trachea, displaced up, elevated carina, elevated left stem bronchus as well. So no doubt about it, yeah? Left atrial enlargement, huge heart. We've got increased pulmonary vein, see here, so pulmonary vein congestion, yeah, if you compare to the aorta. Massive pulmonary vein, okay? And we've got increased opacity perihilar here, around here. This is all atria, this is all perihilar. Increased interstitial pattern. We still can see the vessels. So I would say this is more interstitial. It's actually increased opacity. You've got a dog with left-sided congestive heart failure. We do the echocardiography. Can see it's a nine-month-old dog with a huge left atrium. And there's an incompetence of the mitral valve. The function, the ventricular function is adequate. There is an incompetence of the mitral valve. You can see we have a huge left atrium. This is the aorta here. This is the left atrium. The short axis view, left parasternal short axis view at the level of the aortic valve, basal base. This is where you compare your aorta to your left atrium. So this here, drop appearance of the left of the auricle. That's a nice view. And then it should be less than 1.6, the ratio. Aorta to left atrium is much bigger, probably three or four huge left atrium. Okay. And then you can see if we look at mitral regurg, this is a view from the left, a left parasternal view, a four chamber view. You've got here the mitral valve here. And all this flow here is mitral regurg. Regurg, this green flowing systole. That's a regurg flow that occurs in systole and fills up all the atria. Okay, so it's a severe regurg. Okay, this dog has got mitral valve dysplasia, a severe one, and it's causing left-sided congestive heart failure, has triggered an arrhythmia as well, atrial fibrillation with rapid heart rate, and we need to treat both things. We need to treat the congestive heart failure. And we need to treat the atrial fibrillation as well. So we treat the first the congestive heart failure. We start with furosemide and pimobendan. I'm not gonna go a lot through it, but basically you do. We did on this dog furosemide CRI. You can use 0.5 to 1 mg per kg per hour, and we did that over 24 hours to treat the heart failure. The other option with this dog will be you start on furosemide, ideally IV, really, with these dogs that are bad. And then you can do 2 mg per kg every 4 hours or every 2 hours initially. And then you start spreading into every 4 hours, every 6, every 8 hours as they improve. Okay, we start pimobendan. Later, we would add ACE inhibitor spironolactone in this dog as well. But later, you tend to use to add those later, particularly if there are kidney issues. If they are not, then you could add them to start with, I guess. And then we treat in the congestive heart failure the usual way, oxygen, furosemide, pimobendan, etc. And then we're focusing on treating the atrial fibrillation. So you could do two things. One is to wait for the atrial fibrillation to, for the heart failure to be a bit better controlled and then start. Usually that doesn't work in these cases. So what we tend to do is we start with treatment for AF, being careful. You start treatment AF at the same time you start the heart failure. That's what we tend to do. We start with diltiazem at 15 milligrams 3 times a day and digoxin, a very low dose. You can see how it's very low dose. So this dose of digoxin for diltiazem for this dose will be like 1 mg per kg TID. Okay, the diltiazem we're using now is a diltiazem non-sustained release. Okay. So it's 3 times a day. If you use MR, you could do 3 times a day as well. If you use or twice a day, if you use SR, it'll be twice a day. Okay, but the same dose. It's just a different dose, a different time intervals. And then digoxin, very low dose. If you look at the formulary, we always start on very low dose, maybe small dose 31 micrograms and big dose 62.5 or something like that, because we don't want to cause toxicity. But start low dose and then you can increase potentially. Okay. How do we monitor congestive heart failure? We monitor the respiratory rate, monitor the blood pressure, monitor with X-rays, echo blood test. So we want the respiratory rate to come down. Monitor the blood pressure, not a major drop in blood pressure because of the treatment. We monitor the heart rate as well. The heart rate should come down as we treat the heart failure, as we've discussed before, because the sympathetic tone goes away. Potentially, you could monitor with X-rays or echo as well, but that's often is not needed. Atrial fibrillation, how are we going to monitor? We put a continuous ECG if possible, and we monitor the heart rate. And then we see that AF, the rhythm, is going down. We want it, when we are treating, we want it below 200, 180 to start with, okay, when we're in the hospital still. We don't want, we are not aiming to put a very low heart rate now, because you could have problems with that, and you could put it too low because it's going to come lower later when you control more the heart failure. So you want to just bring it down a bit, okay? So usually we aim for less than 180, less than 200, okay? So what we tend to do is we give the tablet. If the heart rate hasn't gone and the heart failure is going well under control after 8 hours, 12 hours, and the heart rate is still quite high, then we might increase the dose at that time. And then the next tablet increase the dose again, that sort of thing. So, furosemide, we do 3 mg/kg TID, pimobendan, etc. We carry on that way. And then, yeah, we increase the dose of diltiazem, as we said, because we thought it needed a bit more than that. So, we've got to 60 milligrams BID, which for this dog will be about 2 mg/kg, I think it was. So a bit more than 2 mg/kg. We've gone up to 2.5 mg/kg, something like that. And then digoxin, we just keep it the same at the moment. Okay. And then we monitor congestive heart failure. Again, we don't want it too low, but the heart rate at least below 200, below 180 to start with. And then it will settle down, the week after, 2 weeks after, something like that. And we'll monitor and we'll talk about how to monitor long term as well. Now, we carry on monitoring the respiratory rate. So the dog's stable, we're happy how things are, and then the dog goes home. And then dog home, we want to monitor the respiratory rate at home, and we want to monitor urea, creatinine, and potassium later to make sure there's no marked kidney damage. After the AF, after 24 hours, we put a Holter, and then we measure digoxin levels 5 days after starting the treatment. Now, the dog, we stabilized the congestive heart failure. The dog has gone home as I've said with on this medication, furosemide, pimobendan, menacepril, spironolactone. He's gone home with diltiazem 60 mg BID and digoxin. Okay. And now, when the owner comes back for follow-up after a week, 10 days, they say the dog has been fine. The respiratory rate at rest at home has been below 25, so we're very happy with things. We measure levels of protein, creatinine, of urea, creatinine, and potassium. They're normal, so we're happy with that. We measure digoxin levels, and digoxin levels are normal, so we're very happy with that as well. That's very important that you measure those. Always, or we tend to measure some people do peak levels, but we tend to measure trough levels because are the levels that are better established, okay? And we are looking for levels 0.6 to 1.2, okay? In the past, it used to be say levels much higher, okay? But now we know or it's extrapolated from humans, and we suspect the efficacy of this sort of dose, levels of 0.6 to 1.2 is the same with less risk of adverse side effects. Okay, so we're looking for those sort of 0.6 to 1.2. And then we run a Holter. So I will talk about how to monitor this, but we run a Holter, and in the Holter, this is the heart rate, and this is during the day. Yeah? So in the Holter, we see the heart rate doesn't go much above 160 in the day because he was running around at this time. And then when he's sleeping, just goes down to 80 to 90, something like that. But then it goes high again. And we've got a mean around 120, okay, 100, a bit less than 117, something like that. So we say, well, that's fine. We're happy with that. And we'll just leave it that way. Indeed, this dog, I don't know if I've got it later on this presentation yet. So for this dog, we stabilized the dog, it was fine, and then he was sent for surgery for mitral valve dysplasia surgery. Unfortunately, he died after the surgery, but it was quite a bad case. It wasn't so he lived with medical treatment for a few months while waiting for the surgery. And then he went to surgery. Unfortunately, he died after on recovery. But the heart rates and the heart failure was well controlled. So what is adequate rate control? I think usually it's the honest answer is we don't know. There is a recent paper that's shown that possibly heart rates below 120 are better in dogs. Again, in people you tend to go low, but not extremely low as well. So it's just kind of a sensible heart rate. So usually, just to give you some numbers, I don't want to go because we are running out of time. I don't want to go through all the things. But usually, we would go for heart rates that don't go too high, that don't go above 160, 170, 180 top. Heart rates that don't go too low, below 70s or 60s or something like that. This is for patients in congestive heart that have got heart disease and congestive heart failure. For long AF, it's different. You will just go for normal heart rates, really. And then, so up to 160, 170, maybe 180, you might tolerate it if it's just a bit. And then mean, which is what we look at, the average, the mean, around 110, 115, below 120 possibly. Okay, so that's sort of what we aim for. And obviously, the only way to know what the mean has been, etc., and what happened during the day is with a Holter. But the recommended thing is once they've sort, once they settled, then things are fine, you put a Holter on, and then you see how things are during the day. And if you do change of treatment, you repeat Holters to make sure the treatment is fine. Sometimes this is not possible, okay? And then if this is not possible, then a way of doing it would be to monitor the heart rate at the clinic, at home at rest, maybe by the owners, and after exercise, if not just at the clinic. If they come at the clinic, you want the heart rate not to be higher than 160, 170, 180, and the dog being fine. I think if the dog is very stressed and it's 170, 180, then that might be okay. So if the dog is doing well clinically and the heart rate is not above 170, 180, possibly it's fine. But we just can't do much more with that because we're just assessing at the time when the dog is stressed. Okay. Now we have some monitors like this one here, where you can actually take a nice ECG at home with a mobile. Usually these ones work. Yeah, I've just put you the website there if you want to look at it. This one's the owners, or we use it sometimes for AF. So the owners buy this like a casket, almost like a cover for the mobile, and they put it above the heart, and then it gives you a nice ECG, a PDF in ECG, and then the owner sends to you, and then you know what the ECG has been after exercise, in the morning, and a few times during the day, and you get a better idea, I think. So that's another thing that is possible. It's a bit cheaper than two Holters, but it's also, I mean, I think it's maybe £150 or £200, something like that. So there's a cost involved. Obviously, you can use it as many times as you want. Okay. But again, if not, then auscultation or an ECG in the clinic, and then try the heart rate not to be too low. Auscultation is difficult with AF. I mean, even there's this nice and funny thing study where it was assessed the error of calculating the heart rate by auscultation. And you can see on this figure, so this is the relative error in percentage, and this is the groups. Yeah, we've got specialists auscultating, we've got residents and experienced nurses, and we've got veterinary students. And you can see how the error in veterinary students was much higher than those of specialists and residents. But the key thing in this study was that group three, which is the surgeons, the veterinary surgery residents were the worst of all.
And we really like this study. We love it. Just quickly, a couple of things on, again, this will be the most common situation, okay? We have a patient in cardiac disease, in congestive heart failure with rapid AF. And that's how we're going to treat it. We're going to treat the congestive heart failure. We're going to try to decrease the ventricular response rate, the heart rate of the AF, to as low as as low as we can in terms of what the parameters we've set. We're going to try to decrease it quite a lot, okay? The other two scenarios will be, one is that patient where we might want to do cardioversion, okay? So cardioversion usually will be used for patients that have got a normal, so the heart is normal, so they don't have a cardiac disease underlying, so they've got abnormal atria, and the AF is recent as well, so you've just kind of see that the AF has developed recently. You could try with medical treatment like lidocaine. I will talk about lidocaine now. For lidocaine, mainly for vagally induced ones, okay? And the mechanism is not very well known. I'll talk about it now. But the typical drug that we use is amiodarone, okay? Amiodarone for a couple of weeks and see if that the AF resolves. Sometimes these AFs resolve spontaneously, okay? Again, this paroxysmal AF is triggered by something and it might go away. And you give the amiodarone and you don't know if it's the amiodarone or it's just gonna revert anyway, to be honest, because sometimes we've seen it just before giving the amiodarone and it's reverted already. So you could use class 1A as well. If you want to try aim for reversion, usually we would be using amiodarone, okay? Or cardioversion. So cardioversion, we do more and more of those these days. Is basically giving an electrical shock, the same you will do for ventricular for VF, yeah, for a defibrillation. You will do a shock. The shocks are a bit lower than for VF, but you can go high as well. And then basically, it's important is what's called a synchronized cardioversion. So you do the, you need to do it. So it needs to the electrical shock has to be at the time, avoiding the T wave, the repolarization period, because that's where a ventricular VF could occur. So if you fire at the T wave when there are many cells that are in the ventricles, are some positive, some negative, etc., that can trigger VF. So you have to be careful with that, and that's so you need to use a mode of the defibrillator, a mode which most of them have now, which is synchronized defibrillation or synchronized cardioversion, where it marks the QRS complex. And the shocks are done here, okay? Not done in the risk area of around the T wave, okay? So you see here how if you do at the wrong time, you do a shock here, then it can go into VF, okay? So usually you just fire a shock and then you'll have a sinus rhythm. Okay, so we've got a case in Saskia, just go quickly through it. He's a 1.5-year-old Great Dane. He was diagnosed with pneumonia. It was treated and resolved, and Saskia currently is asymptomatic. On a follow-up, we saw an arrhythmia. It's a case I saw in Bristol when I was the cardio service there a few years ago now. On a follow-up, arrhythmia was auscultated with regular pulse deficits and with got AF. You can see it's an AF that is very slow, yeah, slow AF, 70, 80 beats per minute. That will be a very regular, not P waves. Okay, sometimes are difficult to pick up. And what we'll do with this case is we say, well, obviously the heart is normal, heart rate is normal. We suspect this has been triggered by the underlying disease. Let's try to defibrillate. And then what we did was to the theory. You see a video there, to cardiovert, I mean, sorry. So you see a video there of what cardioversion is. So we tend to do, it needs to be under general anesthesia. It's extremely painful. And then we tend to put them on the floor so they don't fall down, etc. And then you'll see how the shock is going to be delivered. Okay, you see there, the shock is delivered. And then before the defibrillation, the cardioversion, we use amiodarone and we carry on amiodarone for a while. Okay, we do a follow-up 2 weeks and it's sinus rhythm, and then we continue amiodarone for about 6 months and then we stop it. Okay. And we know that if you give amiodarone before and after, there's more chances that they the AF will calibrate to sinus rhythm. Okay. And the third case, the last case I've got, again, I'll go quickly because we've gone over time now, and I'm sorry about that. So the case three will be a 7-year-old Rottweiler. There's been they did the cystoscopy as well to remove a pedunculated lesion, and that caused ruptured bladder and acute uric abdomen, and then they had to do exploratory surgery, one of those cases, and had morphine on board, so had high opioids on board. And on recovery, an arrhythmia is noticed, and then they call cardiology. And then we come in, and then we see this rhythm. So there's a supraventricular rhythm, narrow, etc., but with low heart rate, with a low heart rate, but it's AF. Yeah, so irregular, we've got very nice F waves on this one, you can see, so you will all be able to diagnose. Again, these are a bit more difficult to diagnose because it's a bit slower, but it's extremely irregular, NOPI wave, narrow QRS complexes. And what we did was we gave lidocaine at that time. So we gave the lidocaine bolus, we gave a second one, third one, and then it converted to sinus rhythm. Okay, so for these cases where they are suspected to be vagally induced, it is appropriate to give a lidocaine bolus if they convert. If they don't convert, then you could try the amiodarone and cardioversion routes. Okay, and it's not very well known why lidocaine works in these cases. It's suspected to be with with a parasympathetic, with a modification of the parasympathetic tone, basically. In cats, therapy is very rarely needed, because even if they've got AF, their heart rates are usually within what's normal for a cat. So AF is 180, 190. Well, that's often not too bad for a cat. So often they are not treated. Okay. Sometimes if we think it's a bit fast, we might put a halt and see what's happening during the day. But usually, they are rarely treated. So the key thing is to treat the congestive heart failure, certainly not to start with. You will treat the congestive heart failure and you'll see what happened with the heart rate. If you suspect it might be high, it might be better to just put a halter and see what the heart is doing. Okay. And again, if therapy would be needed for a cat, we would use diltiazem as a first choice at 100%. So it would be hypercar, the usual hypercar, so you use that one. Okay. But again, it's not needed to treat AF in cats. As we said, antithrombotic therapy is a paramount of importance in humans with AF, so it's a key thing to treat in humans with AF, but usually it's not required in dogs. We don't use antithrombotic therapy in dogs with heart failure. I think the situation might be different. We had a case a couple of weeks ago. If you have other diseases that make a dog prone to a thromboembolism. Let's say you've got a protein-leucine nephropathy, a protein-leucine enteropathy, for example, something like that, and then or Cushing's, underlying Cushing's, and you've got a dog with heart failure and AF. I think that might make it different, and then you have to consider that AF would be a potential another factor that might cause AF, might cause a clot. But if you've got just a cardiac disease and AF. Then usually it's not needed to treat with antithrombotic therapy. The situation is different in cats, but usually in cats, because they all have severe cardiac disease and most of them are in heart failure, they would be in thrombotic with thrombotic therapy anyway. I guess if you've got AF, you should even consider it more. And then the last slide. It's what's called upstream therapy. Just to try, I've discussed that AF will potentially make atrial fibrosis, etc., in the atria. So there are drugs, what's called upstream therapy, is drugs that try to prevent the deleterious effect of AF in the atria. Okay, and there are different studies and things used are ACE inhibitors, spironolactone. It's suspected that some angiotensin. The angiotensin system might be involved intra tissue, intraatrial in AF development. So this has been suggested. Antifibrotic, spironolactone, omega-3 fatty acids, statins is always talked about in humans. But again, these are things that we don't know anything. And we might treat with ACE inhibitors spironolactone as part of the cardiac disease. We might treat with omega-3 fatty acid as part of cardiac disease if the dog has got cachexia, for example, or something, or they've got arrhythmias, something that can be used, but it's not the key thing of treatment. And it's just, I just wanted to comment or to mention it. Okay. So I think that's all I have. A few take-home messages. The first thing is that a combination of factors are needed to initiate AF, and the most important factor is for the dog to have a large atria, or the cat. Okay, so this big atria might be because the dog is big. Okay, when we diagnose AF on an ECG, always focus on supraventricular rhythm, irregular, and there are no P waves. Okay, don't pay that much attention to whether there is a fluctuate, there are F waves or not F waves, because sometimes they are not there or there might be artifacts. Main therapy we do for AF is rate control, and that's in the vast majority of cases. And it's extremely important to treat the underlying disease. We need to treat that congestive heart failure, that cardiomyopathy very well, and so we'll control AF better. The best we control the disease, the best we control AF. But at the same time, we're going to need some to help the heart, to control the heart rate a bit as well with drugs. Which the main one will be drugs slowing the AV nodal conduction, and those will be in diltiazem, often combined with digoxin, and are the best drugs to use, and the ones we all use as first line, and they are usually effective. Okay. An important thing with digoxin is you need to be careful and you need to measure digoxin levels. If there is risk of kidney disease, the dog is thin, the levels are a bit highish, you might have to measure it a few times along the way. Okay, so be careful with that. And the monitoring of the response rate of AF is better performed with a 24-hour Holter after therapy has been used. But if that's not possible, then there are other strategies that we've discussed, by possible clinical assessment and a 24-hour Holter. Okay, and that's all I have. Thanks a lot, and I'll be very happy to answer any questions. I think a few people have left now, but I'll be very happy to answer. I'm very sorry I've gone a bit over time. Okay, yeah, and Sammy's mentioning, if you have any questions, I'm very happy to answer by email. So to reply by email. So if you want to write me an email, I'll be very happy to do this. I guess you could just Sammy, how should we do it? Shall I give my email? I don't mind. I can't give you my email. I'll write my email here.
Domingo, they can email into CPD Solutions and then I can forward it on to you. Okay. Is that okay?
It's absolutely fine.
On behalf of Webinar Club, then, I'd like to thank Domingo for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.